Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
But first, let's take a look at what is making the headlines today. There are pictures across the front pages of Natasha O'Brien, the victim of an assault in Limerick City, with a megaphone in hand as she led protests in the city yesterday. The Sunday Independent front page reports there were protests in Dublin, Cork, Galway and Limerick in solidarity with Miss O'Brien and in protest over the suspended sentence of a serving soldier, Cathal Crotty. Its main story in the Sunday Independent is lower paid staff losing patience with pilots, cabin and ground crew fearful they will bear the brunt of pay dispute. It comes as 244 Aer Lingus flights have now been cancelled between Wednesday and Sunday of next week. The Business Post is also leading with that industrial dispute with a headline, Aer Lingus pilots threaten more strike days. It contains an interview with the Vice President of Finance with Irish Airlines Pilots Association, who said it reserves its right to increase action up to and including full withdrawal of labour. The off-lead in the Business Post declares McGrath set to be nominated for EU Commissioner on Tuesday. The newspaper says Taoiseach Micheál Martin is expected to brief Taoiseach Simon Harris on Monday night of his choice, and the paper speculates on who might take up the role of Finance Minister if Michael McGrath is confirmed as European Commissioner. The Sunday Times, meanwhile, leads with inheritance tax rather cut to woo voters in final budget. Its political editor, Hugh O'Connell, says Fine Gael wants an increase in the tax-free threshold for gifts or inheritances given by a parent to their child in the coalition's last budget before the general election. The Sunday Times off-lead features an interview with Lavinia Kerwick, whose story led to the introduction of victim impact statements and who has criticised the suspended sentence given last week to Cathal Crotty. The Mail on Sunday picks up that story too with a headline, Gardaí got soldier Snapchat from the US. It claims Cathal Crotty confessed to the attack on Natasha O'Brien after being shown a social media message on Snapchat he thought had disappeared. The Irish Sunday Mirror also leads on the protests in support of Natasha O'Brien, and its off-lead borrows from a Taylor Swift Shake It Off lyric with the headline, Swifties hit by airstrike, call it off, call it off. The Irish Sun on Sunday leads with interviews with two victims of male violence and a headline, We Stand with Natasha. In the UK, newspapers there continue with election coverage and the Taylor Swift selfies with members of the royal family as Taylor Swift continues a series of shows in London this weekend ahead of her arrival in Dublin this coming week. Now, to delve into those newspaper headlines and more, let me introduce our panel here in studio, Pat Lee, political editor of the Irish Times, Ciarán Cough, outgoing Green Party MEP for Dublin, Alison O'Connor, columnist with the Sunday Times, and Emma Howard, economist and lecturer at TU Dublin. Alison, to you first. We mentioned there in the headlines these pictures of Natasha O'Brien with megaphone in hand, images of protest. But first, just remind everybody about this case and how it came to be that we had protests yesterday.
Sure, and I suppose I would like to start by saying... what a woman. I mean, she's an incredible woman, really, really is. But at my age and stage of, you know, with these sort of things happening, I'm sick of it, having to be incredible women who come out and represent themselves and women so well after something like this, and where the entire country justifiably gets outraged. This is one of those stories where you go into a shop or you're in a coffee shop, you're meeting friends, as I did last night, and the first topic of conversation is this. So that we saw that there were protests around the country yesterday. And I think there are a couple of aspects to it. I suppose it's even the very fact that she and her friend became embroiled in this because they were standing up for someone else who was being, you know, who was having homophobic taunts thrown at them. It's the notion that this was somebody who is a soldier who's in the military. There's the history there of the Defence Forces of Women of Honour, and I think people feeling that the Defence Forces in this instance behaved very poorly, and that you'd, and they really need to take a long look at themselves in the mirror. That if somebody, a female family member, said to me or to anyone, I'm thinking of joining the army, you'd say, are you out of your mind? You know, so there's so much work to be done there. And that in the week that a tribunal mm-hmm. was announced for the women of honour. And I suppose it's that people are just wondering, how does this keep happening? And that phrase that the Mail has that story about how the Gardaí were able to go to Snapchat and retrieve that, even though we think that Snapchat, everything disappears. That two sentences, two to put her down, two to put her out. The idea that, you know, that men, and it is mainly men and obviously not all men, you know, in an absolute rage or fueled by drink or by drugs, and that it's in the moment. And in this case, though, we see that subsequent to that, something like that was posted adds to the horror. And I suppose then you have Judge Tom O'Donnell saying that he expressed his horror at what had happened and what had been done. But talking about that if he imposed a custodial sentence on Cathal Crotty, that his career would be over. That patriarchal view of a man and his career and the dominance that must take. And this whole idea of character references, what was said in the court by the military officer. I think for women particularly, it's like, what does it matter what happened in someone's life previously? Why should that give them a pass or ameliorate in any way the punishment that they should receive, having done what he did to that woman, you know, on a public street? And this morning in the Sunday Times, Laura Roddy and John Mooney have a piece in the front page where Lavinia Kerwick, a name that's so familiar to all of us, is basically saying that she couldn't believe judges were still imposing suspended sentences in cases where men inflicted serious violence on women, and raised this issue about women having to speak out to get justice, to have to be, you know, exceptional, to stand out. I was about to say I'm at a loss for words. Clearly I'm not, because I've just been talking for the last couple of minutes. But I'm just so depressed and upset, and as a mother of daughters, you know, as just that this sort of thing can happen, and that you can still have that culture, and that the defence forces can still behave in the same way, that the judiciary can still behave in the same way. You think about Aisling Murphy and what her family must think looking at something like that, and you just think, what are we at?
Emma Howard, you've been looking at those stories as well, the Lavinia Kerwick interview, the interviews with Natasha, the images. What are your impressions this morning?
Yeah, so I would echo what Alison said about, you know, how heroic Natasha has been and how brave she's been. But Lavinia Kerwick said, you know, women shouldn't have to be brave. You know, this shouldn't be part of the process. If you're a victim of a violent assault, you shouldn't have to, you know, and she's an amazing woman, a very strong advocate, but you shouldn't have to be strong enough to stand up and advocate for yourself like that. It's re-traumatizing. And for a lot of women, that's, you know, there's a couple of messages I think that are coming out of this. And one is, you know, for women, that to get justice, You don't just have to have a lot of evidence against you. You also have to be strong enough to be able to advocate for yourself and to fight for that justice, which, you know, is a really difficult thing for a lot of victims to do. The other one, I think, and, you know, as a mother of boys, I think the message it sends to men that you can violently attack a woman and you may not necessarily get jail time. And we know women, you know, we have an epidemic of violence against women in this country. Majority of that is women in their own homes, behind closed doors. If a man beats a woman close to death, she thought she was going to die, in broad daylight, a random woman, you know, what hope to those women who are behind closed doors have in you know, being able to secure justice for themselves.
Pat Leahy, there were protests outside the Department of Justice yesterday. We know when Judge O'Donnell in this particular case was giving his verdict, you know, he talked about it being utterly appalling. He talked about this incident being cowardly, vicious, unprovoked. He talked about the range of factors he had to take account, no previous convictions, an army career, the fact that Crotty had pleaded guilty, which eliminated the necessity for a jury trial. You've seen other cases like this play out before, when it captures hearts and minds of the country. What's your understanding of what the different mechanisms are available now, whether it's the Defence Forces or the DPP?
I mean, I guess there's two processes that will play their way out in a kind of a legal sense now. The first is the process that is underway within the defence forces. And I suppose ministers and so forth have been careful not to say anything that might prejudice the outcome of that. And that's understandable. The second process is the question of whether the DPP, Director of Public Prosecutions, would appeal the sentence on the grounds of undue leniency. The DPP appeals a lot of sentences, so it was a power introduced, I think, back in the early 90s and was very rarely used back then. But it is quite frequently used now. And speaking to some lawyers earlier on, you know, they were suggesting that this happens kind of every week, really. And so I think the DPP has, I think, 28 days or whatever to make a decision on that. For an appeal to be successful, the DPP side in the appeals court, Court of Criminal Appeal, must show that the sentence is kind of beyond the norm of what is usual. There's a wide judicial discretion in sentencing, but the DPP, if the DPP's office does appeal this, it must show to the satisfaction of the appeal judges that the sentence given was outside the margins of discretion. My understanding is that there's a very high rate of success with the with appeals against the leniency of sentences by the DPP. So if that does happen, and the DPP's office is independent in the performance of its role, then I think there's a very strong chance that this sentence would be increased on appeal, perhaps to include a custodial sentence. But that obviously is a matter for the appeals court. Separate to those legal processes, though, I think there is a wider question that won't be silenced by either of those, and that is there's a real public and political energy, I think, building about this now. The victim in the case is very clearly very angry, as she has every right to be, and she's also very articulate, and I think that will fuel a sort of political energy on the thing. So notwithstanding those kind of strict legal processes, which must take place within their own almost hermetically sealed environments, I think this story isn't going away, if you know what I mean.
Kieran Clough, to bring you in on that political energy, you'll be familiar with all of the statistics we see in the papers today from Women's Aid. You'll have seen so many other women coming out and retelling their stories of male violence this morning on foot of this. What strikes you this morning from the victim's sense, but also from the political energy now around this?
I think it's heartbreaking, and I think change moves far too slowly. Two things are on my mind. The defence forces and the reform of the defence forces. There was a very good report, I think, 3 years ago on the Commission on the Defence Forces. And it said very, very bluntly that attitudes within the defence forces were 40 years out of date, out of sync with where society was, and particularly the treatment of women in the defence forces. That has to change. It is changing, but it's moving far too slowly. The second issue is on the very broad issue, and I'm speaking generally, not about this specific case, is the judicial preparedness for dealing with cases around violence and around women. We have a judicial studies committee, and there is a push to ensure that judges have good training and good education, but I think that is moving far too slowly. I just had a look this morning. The Judicial Studies Committee has a work plan, but I'm not sure if every judge is required to undergo training on very simple issues like unconscious bias. And I think it is crucial that judges absolutely understand everything to do with the vulnerability of victims. And I think it's important not that they do this once, but that every few years that there is mandatory training and retraining. I know within the professions that I hold in architecture and planning, we do have a requirement to go back to school to learn what's happening now. And I think it's crucial that within the judiciary that there is this. But look, I think this case has really grabbed the public. Even Pearl Jam mentioned it last night at Marley Park in their concert. So there is a huge anger from the general public, and I hope that that pushes these institutions that moved far too slowly into speeding up and taking action.
Okay.
There was a piece that really struck me yesterday by Michelle McGlynn, who's a young female journalist in the Irish Examiner. She said she was writing about the case on Friday, took a break to go and walk in the Cork City Centre on Friday afternoon. She was catcalled on two occasions. One was a number of men part of a stag do. There were bellowing comments at her. No one batted an eyelid. Part of what makes me so sad and angry is that I didn't expect them to. When I'm catcalled, harassed, grabbed, groped, assaulted, I don't expect another man to step in because I've never really seen it. She says, if you're with male family and friends, it doesn't happen because the perpetrators see that you are and they don't do it. And, you know, until...
There's fear
until
now, there's second-guessing, yeah, isn't there, for people to intervene?
Absolutely, but also I think that women won't get very far with this unless we have more male allies. And there are lots of male allies, but we need far more and need... I mean, I'm very struck by, yes, it is great that that organisations to do with women are female-led, but sometimes it can be then that all the voices that are on representing women and expressing the outrage in that way are female. And that you don't have enough balance there to show that it is indeed, you know, all of society, and to get that message to men who will do something like that, you know, that it's not on.
OK, we will go on now to the other story that's commanding a lot of attention and headlines today across our front pages, which is the Aer Lingus plan strike action, which we know is impacting something like 200 flights. Now, Pat Leahy, you've been looking at this. You've been looking in particular at the pay demands and what that looks like across all of the salary bands for pilots in Aer Lingus. What's the cost of this?
Yeah, there's a very good piece by Ellie Donnelly in the Business Post, and I often think, you know, that, you know, this is the sort of piece that I really want to read when something like this comes up, to tell me the numbers, because people talk in terms of percentages and so forth. But she sets out just the current pay of Aer Lingus pilots and what they would be entitled to under the Labour Court's proposals and what they would be entitled to under the IALPA, that's the pilots' union, what they're asking for. And so just not to throw a whole bunch of figures at you, but just at two levels, for a captain with 26 years experience, their current total pay, that's including salary and a bunch of allowances, is 287,000 a year. And that would go up to, under the under their ask, if that were granted, that would go up to 347,000 euros a year. For a pilot with 10 years experience, current pay all in is 156,000, and that would go up to 187,000. Now, I think, like most people who fly a fair bit, you're in favour of the pilot being reasonably comfortable and happy. I'm not suggesting that if they were unhappy that they would crash the plane or anything, but at the same time, I don't think people in general would have a difficulty with pilots being well paid. However, I think that if this, and everybody, all the commentary across the paper, and it's everywhere across the papers today, seems to be of the expectation that this dispute is at least going to start with some disruption. Maybe that kind of needs to happen as part of the process. But if that does happen over the coming days, and you are left with people at the airport missing their holidays, people stranded and so forth, I think that public sympathy for the pilots at those sort of salary levels, not suggesting that they're entitled to increase.
So talk about that process, because you've seen industrial disputes like this many times through the years, and there's the inevitable calls on the government to intervene, and then there's the calls get back into the labour relations. How do you think this could potentially play out? Do you think there is any role for government? We saw the calls yesterday from the likes of the Labour Party and opposition parties for an intervention.
I think those calls will grow into a cacophony by this time next week. And, you know, Simon Harris has all, Taoiseach has already been out saying that how disgraceful it was that children, the poor children, were being used as pawns in this industrial dispute. And I think what you will see is, you know, it doesn't usually take very long for when there's a controversy of this sort of nature, or a dispute of this nature, it doesn't usually take long before people start asking, what are the government going to do about this? And if the government is on the sidelines saying this is a disgrace, I think that within a couple of days that becomes an overwhelming pressure for action. So I think that you will have to see some sort of government intervention over the course of the week. Whether that comes after you have that initial few days of disruption, that's sometimes the sort of trajectory that you tend to see.
Creates more urgency. Mm-hmm. And Emma Howard, to bring you in with your economist hat on, like, presumably the sense of urgency from the government will come where they see that economic impact. You know, we talked about Taylor Swift concerts next weekend and connection flights and all of the chaos that could come there. But this is about the tourism industry still in recovery mode post-COVID. What are the broader economic impacts that you're seeing in the newspapers today?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge economic impact. And I suppose in terms of what the government can do, the Labour Court has already made a recommendation on this. And what I thought was stark is in that Ellie Donnelly piece is where she actually also looked at the difference between what the Labour Court recommended and what they're demanding. So, you know, it's not just that there's that gap between what they're on and what they want, but the Labour Court recommendation was 9.5%. That's even less than Aer Lingus offered of 12.5%, and the rest of the cabin crew and so on have gotten. So you've got this big gap. Some of the impacts, the cost to Aer Lingus of all of these cancellations is such that sources are now saying that it may well, if it continues, get to the point where they're better off shutting down their operations for a while. So that means, you know, total and utter chaos. It goes from whatever 35,000 passengers were affected, I think, so far with cancellations. Those numbers are going to skyrocket. You've also got the impact of the cancelled flights, but also the impact of the future flights that are being booked. So no Americans are going to book flights with Aer Lingus to travel to Ireland this summer. So we're going to have huge knock-on effects in terms of tourism, in terms of reputational damage. But on the other side, I think in terms of the airline themselves, they're part of IAG. So, you know, there could potentially be contagion here. If they do give in and if they increase their offers, this can have knock-on effects for the sector more broadly as well.
Kieran Cuff, given all of the knock-on impacts that Emma just talked us through, do you think there's an obvious milestone, an obvious junction point whereby the government will just have to intervene here? There is a mechanism open to them?
I think when you look at how many families will be impacted, how many businesses, small business will be impacted, I think it'll put pressure on Peter Burke. He said that the Workplace Relations Commission stands ready, but I think he will be under huge pressure. I mean, it is interesting looking at IAG, the holding company for Aer Lingus. They made a profit of $3.5 billion in 2023. Ryanair made a profit of $2 billion last year. I'm not saying that that justifies any pay increase. To be honest, I'm much more concerned about precarious employment in the airline sector, the ramp leaders, the baggage handlers. A lot of this is seasonal employment. A lot of it is not well paid. And not only in aviation, but a huge amount of my work over the last few years was trying to get decent pay and conditions for people like lorry drivers, who are often the unsung heroes in the transport sector. I know that pulls you right away from the Aer Lingus discussion. But when I looked at those figures that Ellie Donnelly had in the Business Post of perhaps a senior pilot going up to €348,000 a year, these are eye-watering figures. And even with 5 years' experience, the kind of money starts at €74,000, going up to €120,000 when you take in the shift work. These are high salaries. But within this organisation, there's a huge amount of people on very much lower salaries
on
who
that,
need to be thought about.
Alison O'Connor, because those on the lower salaries, you were taking a look at the front page of the Sunday Independent that gets to the heart of some of those tensions now between the lower paid workers and what we're seeing in terms of the salary mandatory bans for pilots.
And I suppose it's even the fact that the pilots are up there in the cockpit and you have the rest of the, you know, the cabin crew and that are front facing or are the people who are in the airports themselves, and the fear that they are going to be dealing with the anger. And I think that if, as Pat says, it will go to the wire where you will have some actual flight stoppages before something is done, I think it's going to be pretty vicious. We've heard a lot in the last year or so about how public anger has affected politics and elections and different things. And I think the idea that people are going to have their holidays and other things interfered with, there will be zero sympathy. It will be wiped out. It was an interesting tweet yesterday on X, Killarney hotelier Tom Randalls, and he's saying that his hotel lost its first booking of six people due to the strike. 10 days golfing tour of Ireland, gone to Scotland instead, and he calculated that being worth 30,000 to Ireland. You know, so that's the other thing. It's not just people travelling, it's the businesses all over the country. And it's also entered the Business Post editorial this morning is saying that it's been more than 15 years of industrial peace at Aer Lingus prior to this week, and this will be the first major dispute in Ireland at a major company since the pandemic. And I suppose I was thinking back last night to when AIG, when the takeover of Aer Lingus and Willie Walsh was in charge at BA, and wasn't it all sort of incredibly smooth? And you'd wonder how much he was doing in the background, because now over the last few days we've seen, I mean, this is vicious stuff. It's really vicious between the two sides. And clearly with a company that's so big and there's so many different airlines, there's a lot more going on and a lot more involved. And I think that does raise the stakes for the government and for the anger. That's already happened, the anger being pushed back, saying in public thinking, you need to do something about this.
The advice to anyone with flights, you know, between Wednesday and Saturday is don't panic. You're going to get rebooked with alternative airlines. But Ciarán, you were looking at a piece where, you know, people are rightly want to put a plan B in place and they're booking alternative flights just to have a backup. And there's a piece in the Mail on Sunday about some people starting to experience like drastically increased fares if they're seeking out alternatives now.
Valerie Hanley and Colin McGurk's piece in the Irish Mail on Sunday, where it says that Aer Lingus rivals are tripling fares amid the pre-strike panic. So look, if people have a wedding booked or if there's a something that they've been saving up for and preparing for many months, if not years, This sends a dagger to the heart of it. So I think everyone is hoping that a resolution can be found. And it's infuriating that other airlines are dramatically increasing prices and making it really, really hard. And people are left really uncertain as to whether they'll be able to claim back the original fare and then facing really high costs of booking a new one.
Well, I think the point is people can't claim back the cost of the original fare if the flight goes. Yeah. So you're left with this dilemma. You know, you put a plan B in place. It's hugely costly, as you say, because all the other airlines have put up their flights.
But I think Aer Lingus is basically saying, we will get you there. You know, people are filling out forms. They might be hours delayed. They could be maybe a day delayed. That's not very helpful to a wedding party. But for the most part, Aer Lingus is saying, we'll get you there. And hence why they're doing all of this form filling with passengers at the moment.
I mean, I know the bride is supposed to be a bit late to the church. I'm not sure everyone would wait around. She
might not tolerate a day or two.
And, you know, they're going to run into capacity issues. Like, they're not going to be able to get everybody there in a timely fashion.
Yeah, it's the knock-on impact of Saturday morning into Saturday afternoon. Okay, you've been listening to Pat Leahy, Ciarán Cough, Alison O'Connor and Emma Howard. We'll be back after these. Welcome back. Áine Kerr here, sitting in for Brendan. You've been listening to Pat Leahy, Ciarán Cough, Alison O'Connor and Emma Howard. We're going to go to the extensive coverage today in the newspapers about the decision of Green Party leader Eamon Ryan to bow out. Ciarán Cough, you're an outgoing MEP. You lost your seat in Europe only, 2 weeks ago. You've probably had a little bit of time to decompress, reflect. Have you given thought yet to running in the constituency of Eamon Ryan, running for the deputy leadership of the Green Party? Do tell.
I'm taking some time off, to be honest, and making sure there's no posters left up, but there's a few stragglers on that front. Look, it's been a really turbulent time for the Greens. But I know that Eamon had intended taking a step backwards some time ago. I think it makes a huge amount of sense. God knows he's been head of the party for, 13 years? I mean, I know it's a cliche of spending more time with your family, but that's actually what he wants to do. I'm very familiar with that myself, because politics does take a toll. It does take up so much time. I always laugh when politicians are asked, you know, what do you do in your spare time? And often there's hapless assistants running around finding some pastime for the politician to talk about, because it is all consuming and it does take up a huge amount of time. And if you do it well, you're there first thing in the morning and last thing at night.
But you're not ruling out a return.
I'm not ruling out a return. I mean, my thoughts, though, on the whole, the huge extensive coverage of the Greens in the papers today, and fulsome tributes being paid to Eamon. I only wish there were some of these fulsome praise before the 7th of June, but Sinn Scéil Ella. But I think the abiding or the biggest thing coming out of all of this is, look, we do have to make a shift towards putting climate change, biodiversity loss at the heart of what we do. And that does change everything. It changes our economy, it changes energy, it changes transport, it changes agriculture. And we cannot hold back that tide. We need to do it in a just way, in a fair way. But I think Eamon Ryan's legacy is that he did shift the discussion. We haven't got all the changes that are needed, but he has certainly shifted the baseline.
Who are you going to back then to shift that baseline, implement that vision you just articulated, Pippa Hackett or Roderick
O'Gorman? I think we've two really good candidates. I'm really upset that it's been pitched as an urban-rural fight because, you know, this damn polarisation. It bedevils us. And I don't think it's appropriate, because I think Roderick has as much to say about rural Ireland as Pippa Hackett has to say about urban Ireland. And I don't think the divisions and the cleavages should be the centre of attention. It's really more, what do you bring in terms of leadership and in terms of what the party can deliver?
Will you be back in one, though?
Look, for the moment, I'm simply saying that we've two good candidates, and there may well be more by Monday evening. It's going to be a tough ask.
Candidates for the deputy leadership or the party leadership, when you say more candidates there?
I think the closing is on Monday evening, and we're already seeing people declare for the deputy leadership.
Would you have any interest yourself?
I in a sense, because I wasn't elected, I don't have a mandate as a candidate. Look, I've many years within the party, but I think now is a time for me to step back and think about what I'm doing next, rather than jumping into the fray in terms of the leadership of the party.
But not ruling out potentially a general election run in the future, maybe Eamon Ryan's constituency.
I'm not ruling out anything, but I just need some time to recuperate, shall we say, from
and some of that time with family. Hopefully, that Eamon Ryan is.
Well, you know, I had No Mo May in the back garden there, but that quickly became No Mo June. So I was trying to make some sense of the 7 foot high nettles yesterday. So a little bit more time.
Pat Leahy, political editor of the Irish Times. There's a lot of analysis about the two candidates so far declared, as Kieran talks about, but then talk of whoever becomes the next leader and the potential again for this left alliance. It's another theme this morning. How do you see this race playing out at the moment? Do you think a left alliance, Green Party, Sock Dems, Labour, do you think there is increasing momentum around that?
It's certainly something that Roderick O'Gorman is talking about this morning. I mean, I do have some sympathy for Kieran and his colleagues looking at the glowing tributes to Eamon Ryan across the papers now and wondering where everybody was for the last 3 years. I know actually that the soft touch treatment of Eamon Ryan this morning extends to bestowing nicknames on him. I think the Sunday Times describes him as Uncle Fluffy, and the Mail on Sunday calls him the Ranelagh Fox. But I think in the Sunday Times as well, there's a piece by our interview with Roderick And he is talking about this idea of a progressive alliance after the next election. And there's been lots of chat about, you know, should Labour and the Soc Dems merge before the election? That none of that is going to happen. They're two distinct parties. But what there is a possibility for, I think, is after the election for parties of the centre-left, Labour, Soc Dems, perhaps the Greens, maybe some centre-left independents, forming a block of seats and negotiating as a single entity to increase their clout, either in opposition or as potentially part of a coalition government. And I think it's interesting, and there's a couple of pieces alluding to this in the papers this morning, but I think it's interesting that one of the leadership contenders, Roderick O'Gorman, who is probably the favourite, I think it's probably fair to say at the moment, for the leadership, is talking about it. And that, if it happens, I think would be a significant departure.
Karen, you want to come back?
Yeah, I just said that piece by Claire Scott and Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Times was interesting to me because it had a Photoshop, again, caricature, Roderick and Pippa on bikes. Are we destined to just be a caricature in Irish politics? But below that cartoon-like image, there was a big ad for a car, for the Lexus, saying luxury is everything, just underneath the bikes. And as you said, Alison, in your piece today, the message of the Greens is one that too many people do not wish to hear. And I think
I think the Green Party will often extol the virtues of cycling, quite rightly, I think. So I think it's maybe a little bit nitpicky to then have a problem with that being how it being depicted to illustrate a piece in the newspapers. And Ger Colleran actually in the Mail talks about this, where he says, as
none
only,
of us should require any convincing on green
as
policies.
Only straight up as only Ger could. Yeah. He said, "We're up to our chin in SH, you know what, of our own making, sinking deeper and deeper into oblivion, while naysayers, conspiracy theorists, imbecilic fruitcakes, and make the world great again nut jobs try to convince us all that what we see with our own eyes and feel with our own senses isn't really happening." I was in the US this week in Boston. And as the first few days in the middle of it, there was massive rain down in Florida and there was flooding. I remember watching CNN and there was a thing across the bottom of the screen, FEMA, you know, the disasters agency, basically saying that they'd already spent like $25 billion on and that the money was running out. And then you had this massive heat dome coming in. I am so glad to say that we left just as that, because it was already really heating up. The friends that I was staying with who lived by the coast, family members were coming up from the city, including older friends, because it was so hot. And there was all over the media. The temperatures, it was record breaking, over 37 degrees. They were talking about cooling centres, which would basically be community centres where people could go to cool down, that had air conditioning. I remember we passed a thing in the city and I said to my friend, "What is that?" And it was basically a flat piece. It looked like a playground, but there was nothing in it. And it was like inner city, and where inner city kids and people, when there was really bad heat, they would shoot water up out of the ground. And I mean, those are examples. I mean, we see them here all the time. We see what's happening in, you know, all over Europe. And there we are being beaten around the head with it. And yet there is this level of denial, which is what Kieran and Eamon and all of, I mean, I think Eamon Ryan must have felt that he died this week when he saw that. And I think they were entirely justified. But I was writing myself only recently as well about how in rural Ireland, I remember it was about 2 or 3 years ago was the first time I noticed it with somebody talking about Eamon Ryan in a vitriolic fashion, almost as if you could buy voodoo dolls of him at country markets. And okay, you can say the Greens need to communicate better. But I mean, there's a complete air of unreality.
The biggest expansion of rural bus services that we've seen in a generation.
Yeah, but you saw Roisin Garvey at prime time this week with Mike Lillywhite. And the Greens need more of that.
Yeah, no,
need
absolutely.
More to bloody fight back and not to take it lying
a bit
down.
Of chutzpah.
You also see it. You see it in Michael Collins, the other independent. There are so many things being peddled and not being pushed back enough. You do need to get on your bikes when it comes to that.
No, you're right. And the Matties and the Michael Healy Rays are all out there putting out their own press releases for the great new bus service that's been delivered.
Yeah, I know.
And ignoring the fact that it was Eamon Ryan delivering it.
There's all that sweetness in relation to Eamon Ryan, but if you want a sour note to counteract it, do read Shane Ross.
I thought that was nasty, really. What did Shane do as Minister for Transport? He ignored Bus Connects. He ignored so many of the big transport questions that need to be
tackled.
And
Shane Ross is entitled to his opinion in an opinion piece
and boy
today.
Does he have
them. We'll let him have that. Emma, one of the other things playing out in the newspapers today, so amid all of this talk of Eamon Ryan, is the speculation on the European Commissioner, that potentially being the Finance Minister, Michael McGrath, which then leads to the whole questions of the budget and will he be around to execute on this last budget of this government. And you were looking at a piece, the front page of the Sunday Times, about the potential of inheritance tax cuts. Now, again, this could be early summer kite flying, as we like to call it. But what did you make of that?
Yeah, it could be. But we know that Fine Gael have been proponents of this for a long time. So, you know, the current threshold, I think, is just 335,000 that you can inherit tax-free as a child from your parents. They are on the record as wanting to increase that to 500,000, and that's not now being touted as a possibility in the upcoming budget. I suppose a couple of things struck me about it, because there's a few articles about housing in the papers today. So really, inheritance in Ireland is primarily housing, and primarily parents passing that house on to one or more children. So if you look at increasing inheritance tax, what you're doing is you're benefiting those who have, you know, those who are wealthier, who have much higher value homes, and you're giving a tax break essentially to people, you know. So they're talking about people being lumped with a very high tax bill because they're inheriting a very valuable property, but they're actually getting a very big tax-free allowance, and then they're paying 33% on the remainder. So I thought, linked into a couple of other pieces related to housing. One is in the Sunday Independent. One of them is looking at this Carrick Mines housing estate, where 40 residents received €75,000 payout from developers to remove their objection to an apartment building in their area. Now, those residents, there's a resident quoted who received one of these payments, and he said that, you know, this was because the development was going to have a negative impact on the value of their housing. And so we've got this housing crisis, but we also...
And there's nothing illegal, we should say, about what residents did, and this absolutely just poses probably ethical, interesting questions.
So it poses, I think, ethical, interesting questions, but also questions on how do we view housing in this country. So it's either an asset or it's a family home and it's a right. So if it's an asset, we should be taxing it. And we, you know, it links again to the debate in Dublin City Council this week about their they're talking about it's not a tax cut or not a tax increase, it's reinstating the property taxes on Dublin homes. Lots of objections to that. So, you know, either we tax the property and we consider it an asset, and so we compensate people if they're impacted, or we don't, but then we...
Pat Leahy, bring you in on this, but also the question, will Michael McGrath be the one implementing potentially cuts like this in the budget? Because the appointment doesn't have to happen, I don't think, for the European Commission until November. I know they want to get their ducks in a row now.
I'll come to that in one tick, but just one observation to make about what you're talking about on the objections. It is a serious problem, you know, in terms of providing housing, not just the, you know, the inevitability of objections, but in many cases, such as in this one, the judicial review is taken, which can delay the process of building the houses by years and years.
And you can see how costly that is, of course, by the fact that they're willing to pay that much money to people.
It strikes me that as a community, our attitude to housing is kind of mirrored by our attitude to climate change, in that we want, everybody wants the housing crisis to be solved, but not necessarily down the road from them. And just as everybody wants, in general principle, everybody wants climate action to take place, but doesn't necessarily want to have to go to the inconvenience of doing anything by it itself.
So who owns this dilemma?
On the commissioner. So it seems to me, and actually the I think it's the Sunday Business Post is saying it as a matter of fact on its front page that Michael McGrath
There'll be a briefing Monday night between the Taoiseach and Taoiseach.
Yeah. And that's certainly my expectation. I mean, Michael McGrath has been kind of the unbackable favourite for some time. I think if he is announced, that he will go pretty soon and there will be a vacancy in
So what
cabinet.
Happens then? There's talk of a mini reshuffle if Roderick, for example, were to win the Green Party leadership. Does he move? If Michael McGrath is on his way to Europe, who takes that slot? Are we looking at a mini reshuffle given that we could have an election as early as October?
It depends on how many you have in mind. If Roderick wins the leadership, then I could foresee no changes in the Green Party representation in cabinet. What would simply happen is that Roderick O'Gorman would then move into the leaders group that meets every Monday night before cabinet and is the real decision-making kind of crucible of this government. Obviously, more changes required if Pippa Hackett would win. If there's a vacancy in cabinet announced this week, which I think is likely, then there's either one of the other Fianna Fáil cabinet ministers moves into the finance portfolio. Lots of speculation again in the papers about that today. Or more likely, I think somebody from the junior ranks, maybe Derek O'Leary or Jack Chambers comes in.
Alison, you want to come in
there? Yeah, you see, I think that's why Eamon Ryan has signalled that he would like to stay on. And while the Greens are different, they're still politicians. They still worry about getting re-elected. I actually think that maybe it looks too much the same old if Roderick O'Gorman, if elected leader, doesn't have some sort of a mini reshuffle. He needs to take himself out of integration, for starters.
Why?
Because he's been the public face of so much disquiet that's been aimed at the government. So that's not good for him. So I think you could see a possible scenario where you'd have a mini reshuffle there. Whereas I understand it, with Michael McGrath will be gone immediately on Tuesday. You're facing in then to an early budget because of an election. I wouldn't be entirely surprised to see Micheál Martin taking finance. Because for me, somebody like Jack Chambers, clearly very able, and who clearly Micheál Martin very publicly put his hand on his shoulder this week by appointing him deputy leader, that he has no senior cabinet experience. Mm-hmm. And to put somebody like that into finance with such a short time ahead of the budget, I think is very high risk. You have to look back to Fianna Fáil's history, back to 2011, back to Michael McGrath last year, making it very clear that as the first Fianna Fáil finance minister since Brian Lenihan, it was all about responsibility and all of that. I think that sends out very different signals. And just finally to say then, you look at this story by Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Times. This is megaphoning from Fine Gael on there. This is, you know, manifesto stuff on inheritance tax. I'm remembering back to the Commission on Taxation. Do you remember in Leo Varadkar saying it was like a Sinn Féin manifesto? And even this idea that they're looking for, where the new minister, Peter Burke, is looking for the VAT for restaurants being reduced. That's in the Business Post as well.
And
the election, you know.
Commission for Taxation and Welfare recommended a lowering in the threshold of inheritance tax.
Kieran Cuff, are you privy to any conversations whether Michael McGrath is the chosen one, and if Roderick O'Gorman did win, do you think that he would do what Alison is suggesting here, hit a reset?
I'm not, in short, but I think significant changes at Cabinet would be somewhat challenging to do when an election is only months away. And Pippa Hackett, of course, does sit. She's a super junior. She sits at
But the party is in trouble, Kieran. I mean, the tide is going out all over Europe. Mm. The party is in trouble in terms of the actual nuts and bolts of how many seats are going to be returned for the party after the next election.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if just shifting Roderick out of integration. Mm. What I would like to see is greater government responsibility for integration. Mm. I mean, looking at it from where I was in Brussels, I was constantly scratching my head that it seemed like Roderick was in charge of taking on 100,000 Ukrainian refugees and taking all responsibility for them, when surely it should have been a whole of government approach. And I think if Roderick was leader, I think he would be able to state that perhaps more clearly than it had been stated heretofore. Just on the commissioner issue, I think the earlier that Ireland appoints its commissioner, the better. What I noticed over the last few years is that there is definitely first division, second division, third division, and even fourth division commissioners. So the earlier you get in the door on that one, the better possibility possibility of getting a senior job. And I think McGrath is very well placed to get a high level job.
Can I, we'll be back from the news with more from the newspapers after these. Welcome back. Áine Kerr here, sitting in for Brendan. Our panel today is Pat Leahy, political editor of the Irish Times, Kieran Cuff, outgoing Green Party MEP for Dublin, Alison O'Connor, columnist with the Sunday Times, and Emma Howard, economist and lecturer at TU Dublin. Pat, you were taking a look at a story in the Sunday Independent from Wayne O'Connor about this idea of social media apps carrying kind of health warnings, kind of like the tobacco style warnings that we've seen through the years.
Yeah. Minister for Education, Norma Foley, has asked the Online Safety Commissioner to consider this mood. Now, as I understand it, she's, you know, it's up to the Online Safety Commissioner to draw up the code, and it is a voluntary code. So you're a couple of steps away from social media apps having to carry health warnings on them. But I think there's growing international awareness of the damage, or the potential damage, that social media use, heavy social media use, can do to, particularly to teenagers. So I think it's the sort of thing that would have a lot of support. In parallel, of course, the Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin told his Ard Fhéidh a couple of months ago that Fianna Fáil would introduce a ban on smartphones in schools. So I think that might be a more direct and maybe more kind of kinetic action, which would be actually in the you would think the Minister for Education might be in a better position to do than influencing the Online Safety Code. But of that, I have heard little since the Ard Fhéidh.
Do you think the government is constantly trying to manage a tension, though, between these corporations? They want the jobs in Ireland, but yet, no, they have to increasingly regulate and impose more structures and systems.
Yes, to a degree. I think we all know at this stage, though, that the social media giants will only do what they are compelled to do. They will want as little interference as possible with their highly lucrative commercial operations. And it is only when they are regulated that they will do what government wants. So it seems to me and I understand the commercial or economic imperatives of keeping them sweet as well. You look at the corporation tax, the corporation tax that the government politicians will spend the entire summer arguing over how to spend. So I do get that part of it as well. But I think if there's one lesson from how the social media companies have behaved, it's that they will only respond to regulation.
Alison, you were looking at something a little bit more lighthearted, but we've all had these moments in the last few weeks of trying to open the milk and the and trying not to flip our lids. What were you learning about this
Sunday Times today? Is like a public service in the Sunday Times, in that a lot of people still aren't aware. I was chatting to some people about this over the weekend. So this is a piece by Stephen Bleach, and it's basically, I noticed myself a few weeks ago, you know, it was milk cartons, and then you're thinking, am I imagining this or is this now a thing? And then realising it's now a thing. So this piece explains that it's part of an EU directive, surprise, surprise, and that the caps must be permanently tethered, and that basically they're quoting an expert who says that anything smaller than a tennis ball will get lost in the recycling process and that. But again, you're back to the whole thing of people getting angry and outraged, and it's just the public mood, isn't it? We'd fight with our own toenails.
Very quickly, EU directive, it's a feature, not a bug, Kieran.
It actually was one of the came in 2019, just before I was elected, because I was scratching my head. I don't remember this going through the
Parliament. He's washing his hands of it already.
But actually, microplastics, they're being found everywhere. They're being found in polar bears in the Arctic. I even saw something recently saying that they are being found in men's penises.
Good Lord.
I think if we want to try and tackle the pervasive amount of pollution and crap in our seas, in our land, in our bodies, we need to have these things that can be somewhat uncomfortable, such as caps that are attached to a milk bottle, milk carton.
The last word there was from Kieran Cuff, outgoing Green Party MEP for Dublin. You've also been listening to Pat Leahy of the Irish Times, Alison O'Connor, columnist with the Sunday Times, and Emma Howard, economist and lecturer at TU Dublin. Thank you.